This is Larry Levitt from KaiserNetwork.org. Welcome to Ask the Experts, our regular interactive web show that provides in-depth discussion of current health policy issues. States have been very much in the news this week as the nation's governors met with President-elect Barack Obama in Philadelphia. Among other things on the agenda, an increase in federal matching payments for the Medicaid program. Meanwhile, there's growing interest in a possible overhaul of the nation's healthcare system. Yet while states have major responsibility today for providing coverage to low-income Americans, there's been remarkably little discussion of what role they might play in a new national reform effort. Should states serve as laboratories of ideas with substantial flexibility to structure reform approaches? Or should a nationwide structure be created to govern how people get coverage, no matter where they live? And what level of discretion would states have in such a system? Today we're joined by an esteemed panel of experts to discuss these and other issues. Stuart Butler is Vice President for Domestic and Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Henry Aaron is at the Brookings Institution, where he's a senior fellow in economic studies. Alan Weil is executive director of the National Academy for State Health Policy. And Judy Fader is a professor at Georgetown University and a former health official in the Clinton administration. As always, you can submit questions at any time during the show by emailing them to ask@kaisernetwork.org. Thanks to all of you for joining us. And Stuart, let's start with you. You've proposed, along with Henry, an idea that states would take the lead on healthcare reform. Describe how that would work. How would you?
It may not be exactly take the lead. It's more that respond, in a sense, to a challenge at the national level to say we're trying to reduce uninsurance, we're trying to reach certain objectives. Let the states come forward with proposals, radical proposals, different ideas about how to achieve those national goals so that you could have one state trying one way, one state trying another. By doing that, you learn what works, what doesn't work. You also recognize that that variety is very important in the United States in terms of what might work better in one place than another. You hold states to account to actually accomplish this. And you allow them to propose significant changes in existing federal programs to allow them to do that. Like you could have Medicare for all in one state. You could have something based on health savings accounts, say, in another state. Have the kinds of changes in the law that are not permitted under the current arrangement.
And you talk about states experimenting with a wide variety of approaches and, mm-hmm. and changing existing federal laws. I mean, would anything be on the table here? I mean, Medicare, ERISA?
Well, I think those who are looking to do this on the Hill would say there would be certain limits of, in order to have some practicality to it. There are certain things it's probably wiser not to touch, first of all. But the idea is to say, what is the best system that actually works? So I think proposing significant changes is exactly what you want states to do. I mean, the bottom line is, can we actually achieve the objectives in a more effective way by restructuring what we currently do? Try things that are different. We think that you're more likely to see that happening, new ideas being tried, if you allow individual states the option to do that, rather than trying to do everything nationally in one fell swoop. I think politically it would be very difficult to achieve that with the kind of degree of innovation that I think we really need. But by keeping a national objective, national goals in mind, you're not just letting 50 states go in 50 different directions with totally different goals.
Henry, I mean, as Stuart's co-author on this, I mean, Stuart talked about these national objectives. What would states have to do in order to kind of qualify for this approach?
I think the first requirement is there would have to, as a practical matter, for the reasons Stuart suggested, there'd have to be a do-no-harm proviso that would apply both to Medicare and Medicaid enrollees. That doesn't mean the benefit structures would necessarily have to be rigid and unchanging, but it means that those who are provided benefits under these programs would have to end up no worse off and possibly better off than they are today. But I think there's a fundamental point here. One way or another, the states are going to be involved. Until the economic collapse, this is a paradox, I believe. I would have suggested that the odds of national reform were close to nil. Paradoxically, the prospects for national action may have increased because of the crisis, because of the fact that a limit in normal circumstances on healthcare reform was that you really couldn't spend a great deal more than the base system. With large amounts of fiscal stimulus and financial support being distributed by the hundreds of billions of dollars to various organizations at the present time, That constraint on health care reform is weakened. But even if there's a national bill, the starting point for states where they're beginning, what they're doing now, are so different, and their needs and preferences are so varied, that I think there is inevitably, even in the national plan, going to be a very substantial amount of variation across the states. And given history, one can't dismiss the possibility that the national effort might not wholly succeed. And if that should be the result, then the ball is squarely in the court of the states. They would be the vehicles through which systematic reform would have to take place.
So I want to make sure, because you and Stuart have both talked about how this kind of state lead, state flexibility approach wasn't necessarily either of your kind of first option, but it was maybe the more politically palatable, more politically potential option. And you're saying now that, you know, with the financial crisis, paradoxically, maybe there's a better chance for national reform. But even then, you'd still build in quite a bit of state flexibility into whatever national approach you took.
Look, we've got more than 20% uninsured in three states. We've got less than 10% uninsured in four or five states. We have a third of California enrolled in HMOs. They virtually don't exist in a number of other states. Spending varies 2-to-1. We're starting from a situation in which the way in which states organize, deliver health care and the price of health care is hugely different. And it's going to take time to narrow those differences so that we have to start where we are. And that will be true of a national reform that tries to establish long-term goals for coverage and financial accessibility, and it'll certainly be true if those efforts don't succeed and the initiative remains with the states.
I mean, you also talked about the first objective maybe being no harm and ideally making people better off. So would you not necessarily go as far as to say every state should guarantee universal coverage, let's say?
The idea that Stuart and I put forward did not contain a requirement of universal coverage. What it contained is a requirement that states come forward with credible plans for increasing the proportion of people in their borders who have health insurance. They would receive a measure of regulatory flexibility, perhaps some legislative waivers that would help them blend funds or change rules for under certain programs. And in my view, at least, they would also need to have a modicum, at least, of financial assistance. And something that I don't think we early on paid enough attention to, fiscal protection against the obligations they would have incurred in the event that the economy turns weak. That's something that has become graphically clearly necessary in recent months. And it seems to me is an absolute essential if any significant number of states were to move ahead.
Well, let me bring you in. You've served at the state level. You represent state officials now at the National Academy of State Health Policy. You know, what, in your view, if states were to move ahead, I mean, right now, if you look at what states have done, Massachusetts is well along into implementing a coverage expansion, near universal coverage. A handful of other New England states have made some progress, not much progress elsewhere, at least in terms of major reform. You know, what's missing? What would states need to move ahead in a big way?
Well, I think to move ahead in a big way, states need a national framework, which I think is much more than a sort of a competitive, select a few states approach that Henry and Stuart have laid out, partly because I don't really see the federal government being willing to change Medicare and think about ERISA and send a lot of money, which frankly is a lot of what it takes to cover the uninsured, to a few states while they're doing nothing in other states. I don't see the interests that are concerned about fragmentation around the country saying, oh yes, we want more diversity around the country than we already have. So I'm skeptical about the federal government's willingness to hand out special permission to a limited number of states and special funds to a limited number of states and say, move forward. By contrast, though, I think in the context of a national framework that says we as a country are going to all move in this direction, and we're going to put on the table the fundamental questions about the roles of employers, the roles of individuals, how are we going to pay for this, and we're going to put things like the heavy hand of Medicare payment systems, which structure how the rest of the healthcare system pays and therefore prevent state and private payers from necessarily moving in directions that people think would be more efficient and effective. We're going to put the role of health information technology, where everyone says it needs to be interoperable so it can't all be done at a state-by-state level. We're going to put those issues on the table, and within some context of a national framework and national decisions about those core issues, that's a structure in which I think states can move forward. I also just want to note that, you know, we talk about states as laboratories, and Massachusetts always comes up. It's a very exciting model. But across almost all of the issues that people are discussing in healthcare, far beyond coverage, but including coverage, the state leadership has been tremendous. And it's not sort of a question of whether states are or are not going to be laboratories or whether they should or shouldn't lead. The fact is, from the state's perspective, they've been leading because they haven't seen much leadership out of Washington on most of the issues that they care about. So whether it comes to reforming delivery systems, multi-purchaser initiatives around quality and changing medical practice, whether it comes to information technology, there's certainly been a federal role, but the states have already, I think, shown the way forward on many of these issues.
And is there also a role for states, in your view, to act as true laboratories, where they're testing out different ideas, seeing if they work or not, having that then feed into a national discussion or feed into debates in other states? I mean, is that something that actually works out in practice?
Well, With limitations, I mean, when we're talking about comprehensive or major reforms, the laboratory metaphor doesn't really work. You've got too many variables, too many things are changing, and too many things are outside of a state's control. So you don't really know if it didn't work because the state did it poorly, they had a bad idea, the federal rules were never changed in the right. We can't think of it in that sort of very hard science way. But the flip side is whether it's politically, administratively, or from a policy perspective, states already do serve as laboratories. Ideas come up, patients' bill of rights comes up through the states and makes its way onto the national scene. Administratively, trying to figure out how to enroll and reach children and adults who are already eligible for public programs. And then the coverage expansions, not just the comprehensive approach in Massachusetts, but many other states as well. So it's not sort of an either or, they will be or they won't be. There is enough variation around the country that we will always be learning from the diversity across the states. And I think we should want to continue to do that learning, and we will, but we should also, I think we should avoid the notion that, you know, the real answer right now is federal inaction, 5 years of states functioning as laboratories, at which point someone will stand up and say, state X got it right, we all agree, and that's going to be the national plan. I can't think of an example of that happening in other policies, and I don't think we should expect that in healthcare.
Let me say, I agree completely with what Alan said about that, but I believe there is one dimension in which state experience can serve a kind of laboratory-like function, and my example would be Massachusetts. They're implementing a plan that is intended to cover everyone. They find they can't cover everyone at the outset. So they encounter a host of administrative challenges that they are, in real time, having to solve. Well, how Massachusetts solves those problems will provide information in the context of either other state reforms or a national effort on how one edges into increases in coverage if resources aren't sufficient to cover everybody. There will be issues of influencing the price of services that will arise, the modes of delivery. I think we haven't gotten there yet, but I think it's morally certain Massachusetts will get to those if their plan continues to work. And all 49 other states will learn something from how Massachusetts does that. It's in that sense, I think, that the states can be laboratories, not that they're going to produce data one can plug into a regression analysis.
I just have to say, although I agree, as always, with you, Henry, I can't help but think of the experience of Medicare Part D. Half the states had senior pharmacy assistance programs. None of them had a donut hole. None of them tried to dump everyone in on the same day. And when the federal government decided to do it, they largely ignored the experience of half the states in the country. So I think we can learn. I think states can learn from each other. The federal government can learn from the states. But it doesn't just happen magically. It really takes a lot of work to learn those lessons.
And Henry, would you make a distinction between the kind of learning that's gone on as Massachusetts implements the plan, which I think you know would come with the implementation of any plan, and you would make kind of changes as you kind of learn how things work? I mean, are those? I guess what I'm asking is there a difference between kind of testing fundamentally different approaches, as you all have talked about, versus kind of bumps in the road and how you deal with those bumps in the road?
Were the federal government to make it possible for states to move ahead, and I think Alan is raising some legitimate issues about whether politically and practically that would turn out to be feasible, but were the federal government to do that, my own view is that the degree of variability across the states may turn out to be less than current ideology would lead one to expect, because the nature of the problems, state diversity notwithstanding, the nature of the problems that the states confront are rather similar. The Massachusetts example is instructive. It is a bipartisan plan with ideas taken from both the political left and right. It was a very pragmatic reform. And willy-nilly, I think other states are going to be driven into those sorts of compromises, whether we're talking about the People's Republic of you can name whichever state you want, or very conservative central mountain states of the United States. The problems, I think, are going to push the states into not terribly dissimilar approaches.
Judy, let me bring you in. I mean, in some sense, you know, I think what we're talking about is in some ways matters of degree. I mean, if there's some kind of federal legislation, which I think everyone is talking about, to what degree does that set up a structure, a framework, guidelines, requirements that, right, that states would have to meet, or and how comprehensive and stringent are those? From fairly loose to, you know, fairly prescriptive.
Yeah. Given the nature of the discussion, Mike, I feel a need to say something really quite different, which is whether it's the change in the economy that has created some potential for being able to invest in healthcare, which we've not seen, again, the political willingness to invest, which we've not seen since I can remember, or the discussion during the election, the concerns preceding the economic crisis that have elevated attention to health reform. I think that right now we have a moment when we can and hopefully will move forward at a national level. And so I, in answer to your question, Larry, I think I would focus on what the national plan is. And then, of course, there will always be variations in healthcare on the ground, but not, I don't think, differences in needs, preferences when it comes to what we need to specify nationally is needed in health reform. And to specify some of those things, I think we know a lot of things. When it's not a question of experimentation, we know a lot of things. We know that people need to have a full range of benefits in order to cover them when they're sick, and without I think we know donut holes are a matter of political or fiscal problems or unwillingness to invest. So we know what benefits need to look like. We know that when insurers can discriminate based on or can pick and choose, cherry pick, whatever language we want to use, that insurance is not spreading the risk the way we need to, so that we know we need a real risk spreading mechanism that everybody can participate in. And we know a lot about affordability and what people, we make decisions on values as to what we expect people to pay. But we know that we've got lots of evidence from lots of experience that tells us that when people have to pay too much, they don't get health care when they need it. So I think that the specifics of what needs to be there is clear. I also think that when we talk about how we put this together, and I think we should be working off President-elect Obama's outline, is that when we're talking about building on the current system and moving forward, I think that requires a national effort to do it in a way that gets everybody the same protection and also treats employers, individuals, and taxpayers nationally on a similar basis rather than picking and choosing across states.
And do you think there's room in that for diversity, let's say, you know, a single-payer system in one state, an individual mandate in another, state, you know, employer requirements in some states, not in others?
I think there will be variation. I think that the variations that I see is likely to happen would be on the administrative level, whether how potentially a state would want to set up its own network or purchasing cooperative or whatever we're calling those things these days.
Like an exchange.
That might be state specific as opposed to national, that enrollment mechanisms might vary. I see the primary variations occurring on the administrative side rather than in the overall plan design side.
If I can just respond to that, I think that there's maybe less than meets the eye to what we actually know. I think there is agreement, and I think as Judy put it, there's certain agreement on broad objectives that we all have, absolutely, with regard to spreading risk differently and so on. We can probably have a lot of agreement on precisely what the end result is we're looking for. It's when you get down to what is, in fact, the best way to achieve that, where, you know, people can argue and do argue about what in practice is the best way. I mean, for example, spreading risk. I don't think for one moment there is a general agreement on precisely how to do that among people who all agree that it should be done. And that's precisely what Henry and I's proposal and others who support us argue, that we've got to have a mechanism in place to find the best ways to move forward for those kinds of objectives. And that's what we're really talking about. So I think the idea of saying, well, we know exactly what to do with regard to insurance structure and benefit design and so on, and so we can just sort of do it here in Washington in one fell swoop and give the states just a little bit of flexibility as to exactly which forms you fill in or something like that, I think that is way different from the actual situation. There are big differences, as Henry said, on the ground right now. There are big differences in what actually would work in one state than another, given those situations. And there's disagreement about the best results. And 10 years from now, we will see changes in the health system in any case that may even mean that what we think we knew and put into place nationally 10 years ago is in fact not going to work as well today. So you've got to have a continuous process of reaching commonly agreed positions and goals in ways that allow the best ways, the best designs to be tried and compared with each other. That's what we're talking about. You cannot do that nationally.
And do you think, because I mean, you're all saying there's these commonly agreed goals, but I think when we started out, it didn't sound like there were commonly agreed goals. I mean, for example, I'll just throw out a few. I mean, universal coverage or not, the level of financial protection for people. I mean, how much they are required to pay in premiums. Those seem like kind of fundamental principles that I'm curious whether
there
is
agreement.
Examples,
I think, of goals where you can agree on the broad goal. Yes, there should be a move towards universal coverage. Anybody in America should know that they can get available, affordable health care. The debate is, what is the best way to design that? What is the right level? The side effects of doing it in a certain way, as we know with things like community rating and, for example, in health insurance, there are sometimes consequences that then cause you to refine your initial approach to doing something. So I think there are lots of cases where we do, in fact, agree on the broad objectives, where the precise levels, the precise type of benefits, the speed of which we move towards universal coverage and so on, that's where I think there are practical and quite frankly, you know, almost theoretical arguments about how best to move forward. And that's what I think we need to accept, that the states have a critical role in conducting the kinds of diverse approaches within those common themes that allow us to learn, allow us to have appropriate variation that reflects what we know and don't know and the differences between states. And I think that's what we're talking about. So there's going to be an argument, and Henry and I will be arguing with each other, I'm sure, about what a national framework should look like, the degree of that framework. But within that, whatever one agrees on that, whatever the debate turns out to be there, then a process to allow states to say, here's a better way of reaching what you try to do in Washington, I think makes eminent sense, is exactly the right way to go, and is completely consistent with the American concept of federalism.
I find a confusion in the argument, because I think that when we put forward that there are things to be learned about what works and what doesn't, that's one level of argument. And I put forward for the moment that if we want to learn things of that nature, there was a time, it's been a long time, when we had demonstrations that run at the federal level to actually explore different ways of doing what is agreed upon as a common goal. Now, the confusion is between that kind of technical thing and political and value choices that are made by us as a society. And Henry, when you've talked about the way thinking that all states will come to a common position, what you're really talking about here are political choices. And I believe that we're talking about what we ought to have as citizens of the United States, as Americans, and that requires making those, or that those value choices and political decisions are best made at the national level for the whole nation. So that when it's politics and values, we're not talking about experimentation. There's another point that I would make. I'm kind of surprised, Alan, to hear you talk about or not be more critical of what one gains from experimentation, because my recollection is that you've written a book with John Hollihan and was it Josh Wiener, that actually looked at the arguments for states as laboratories in healthcare and found really very little evidence that there was much learning of that kind. So I think that if we're looking at if we look at the technical end, I don't think there really is that kind of states as laboratories. I think that much more of this is about politics and values than this discussion suggests. And if we're talking about politics and values, I believe that the time is now to address those at the national level.
A lot of those demonstrations to which you referred occurred through waivers that were granted to states.
That deterred, but the initial waivers, when I said we haven't had that concept, I'm glad you re-raised it because I didn't finish my thought,
I didn't mean I was helping to strengthen it.
But that's a yes, but you are, actually, because there was a time going back to the 70s and probably some of the 80s. I don't remember them all, but I remember in the 70s and probably early 80s, the long-term care, the home and community-based care demonstrations, that they were federally sponsored demonstrations taking place in states. But what happened in the 90s to those waivers is evidence of what I'm talking about. They no longer became any kind of demonstration of different ways to do things. They essentially became recognition or a decision to allow states to do things the way they wanted to.
Well, let me say a few things here. First of all, I want to go back to something Henry said earlier, which is about in this question about whether states are close together or far apart. At least a dozen states have had task forces or legislative bodies designed to look at comprehensive reform, and it is true. Overwhelmingly, they all adopt a similar structure. There's variability around an individual mandate, but it's expand Medicaid, simplify eligibility, support families with income subsidies, try to bring the premium down, which of course is a little black box that we don't quite know how to fill. But I think there is a center, if you will, out among the states, despite the variability we see out there. And with respect to the demonstrations and learning, I really think we have to differentiate between learning and then doing things that cost money, and learning and doing things that improve administration mm-hmm. and otherwise affect the delivery mm-hmm. system. The reality is states have been talking about and experimenting with, for example, sliding scale premium subsidies for a couple of decades. A couple of states led, other states didn't follow. Why? Because they didn't have the resources or they didn't have the political will, however you want to describe it. It's not that we didn't know how to do it. When it comes to the delivery system, there are many more opportunities and there is much more learning. And I actually think the contrast between long-term care, which is not usually part of the typical health reform debate, where there's been a tremendous amount of learning and also a tremendous amount of frustration about the pace of spread of what's been learned, I think that's a more a realistic statement about what states can and can't learn from each other. Where it's just about, are we going to learn what state A did to cover more people and state B is going to come along and write the check, I do think there are limitations. The last thing I would say is, I think Medicare offers us an interesting example of what it means to have federal policy, because clearly the federal commitment is there, the federal structure, the federal benefit package. But lo and behold, despite all of that, the state-by-state and local issues are huge. There are huge payment disparities. When you move into managed care, do you do it in one region? Oh, they have it in one region, so we should increase the rates in another region so that we can attract managed care plans. We want to do demonstrations. We try to pick a region to test it. But then the political forces, the interest groups come out and say, don't test it in our backyard. So I think even within the national framework, there is a lot of room and there are a lot of local and state-based issues. That's really what I was trying to get at with the sense of experimentation. It's not just leave the states alone. I don't think that's what states are saying and it's not what they want. But I also think even when you go as far in a national plan as Medicare, which is sort of the prototype of a fully national plan, there still are a surprising number of state and local issues left behind.
Let me ask you, because Medicare maybe offers a good transition to considering, you know, let's say different approach. I mean, we have a new president-elect who's laid out a national framework, different from Medicare, but similar in that it's a national, it would apply everywhere. In Medicare, I mean, you talk about variations across regions or states. Those are not driven by state decisions, though, state government decisions. And if you look at President-elect Obama's plan and most of the plans that have come out recently, there's very little talk of what discretion states might have. I mean, what in your view are some of the areas where even within a national framework states might, you might introduce some state discretion or flexibility?
That's a tough question, and I think the reason you don't see much talk about it in the national plans is because they're national plans. And so when you're running for office, you don't say, I'm going to guarantee that you're going to get whatever your governor wants you to get. You say, I'm going to guarantee that you're going to get what we as a nation decide you're going to get. At the end of the day, I actually think it is critical that we make national decisions about the fundamental value choices that Judy described. I mean, outgoing Secretary of HHS Mike Leavitt said when he went around the country, he talked to different governors, and they had different sense of what the benefit package should be. He said, in Vermont, it won't surprise you, it's going to be very comprehensive. In Tennessee, Governor Bredesen said, we don't need so big a package. Well, why was that difference? It's not because people's health care needs are different in Vermont and Tennessee. It's because the financial resources available in those two states are different. And if you look at what they're doing, it reflects the resources available. So I think there's a we make a mistake by saying by always saying local policies just reflect local values. They reflect local values and local realities. And the values maybe should be reflected in the policy, but the local, every country in the world that has a national policy has some kind of redistribution. That's a heart of most federal systems. So I do think we need to make core decisions at a national level. How are we going to finance this? I don't think it's realistic to pit states against each other in whether they're going to tax businesses and worry about they're going to cross boundaries. I don't think benefit packages, at least at the fundamental level, should vary, although presumably some of the income cutoffs where people's standard of living and ability to afford benefits might vary. I see huge opportunity around the delivery system. But again, so much of delivery is driven by financing and payments. So somehow you have to build a system, and maybe this is the part where I start sounding a little bit more like Stuart, where we say within some boundaries about how to approach it, let's experiment with some differences in how we change payment so that we can actually drive out this 30% of waste in the healthcare system, which is not going to happen through some national fiat. So I think there's room, not just administratively in sort of the technical check the boxes, but in how you put things together on the ground. But if you ask states to do that without a national framework, I think you're going to have them battling each other and feeling constrained in ways that prevent them from...
I mean, I certainly agree with that in broad terms, but I think it sort of underscores the difficulty of trying to do everything or a lot at the federal level, or as much as at least you're suggesting. The debate over core values, for example, President-elect Obama said, among other things, that choice of doctor, choice of care is a critical principle. He said that if you've already got coverage, nothing will change in that coverage other than the cost will go down. He's also suggested mechanisms such as a public plan that would be in competition with other plans, which in all probability will lead to big changes in people's coverage who are already covered. We've already got a bit of a difficulty getting all these core things straightened out at the national level. Whatever we do to try to do that, in all probability, we will see unintended effects, or we will see that it will operate differently in different parts of the country. It is very important to say whatever we make, whatever decision we can make about what those core objectives are and the best way we think to achieve them, in all probability, we will see that not operating according to plan right across the nation. And therefore, you must allow states to propose other ways of reaching that. Now, under current law, of course, states, as Alan has already pointed out, that have constraints on what they can do. They're very limited according to existing law. That's why the idea of legislative waivers is so important, to allow states to propose changes in the law to permit them to do things that are completely in line with the national objectives that we've laid down and the goals that we want to achieve. That's what we're talking about. It's not just a little administrative tinkering here and there. The fundamental decisions at the national level are going to be hard enough, both in terms of what we really mean by these values, but also the architecture at the national level, the probability of getting that right in the way Congress works is, I think, near zero of getting it perfectly right.
Stuart, let me just press you on that a little bit in terms of the legislative waivers. We talked a little bit earlier about ERISA, which governs how or circumscribes how states can either relate or put requirements on employers. You know, the tax system plays a huge role in subsidizing the health insurance system, and you've Absolutely. Talked in the past about approaches to change the way the tax system subsidizes health insurance. How easy would it be for states to test out alternative approaches if an ERISA waiver is not, let's say, possible?
Well, let me say, first of all, let me take the tax case first, that there's a general principle that I think there's broad agreement with, which is if we're going to give subsidies to people, it probably makes sense to focus those subsidies as much as we can on people who need it most. The way the tax treatment operates completely violates that principle. Now, how exactly you would change it and so on, there's going to be debate about, but I think there's a broad agreement there. Let us take the case of ERISA.
But would you, on the tax, would you mm-hmm. change? Would that be a change you would make federally, or would that be a change you might make?
Well, it's a federal tax system. In that sense, you would have to do it nationally. Henry and I have talked about if we couldn't do it nationally, trying to find ways of structuring subsidies such that you begin to move in the direction that you want to do. If you can do it nationally, you do it nationally. I'm not opposed to doing things nationally that there's a broad agreement on and are really going to create the conditions necessary to help us reach our goals. But take ERISA, for example. In principle, one could say one should make changes in ERISA in order to permit a more consistent approach and so on. Let's say, for the sake of argument, that you can't do that, that the votes are not there for ERISA. Does that mean that you don't essentially do anything? Or do you say to the state, has somebody got an idea with ERISA in place to work around in some way, to try to develop an approach for those that are not covered by ERISA, or maybe for firms that might decide to go into a different system if it's more attractive? Let's see what you propose. If you think national only, you've got to deal with ERISA. If you can't deal with that politically, you're sort of stuck. We're suggesting ways of not being stuck.
On ERISA, I think there are actually compromises mm-hmm. that should satisfy the legitimate interests of advocates of ERISA, those who like the current system, and those who would like to see a measure of flexibility for states. And the provision is very simple, and it takes advantage of the ideas that you just articulated. You establish national standards that plans qualifying for ERISA must satisfy in terms of the value of benefits or access to care. There are non-discrimination rules that apply in the tax system. Analogous provisions would apply here. The idea being that as long as a company's plan meets these standards, they enjoy ERISA protection. That would, if those standards are ones that command general national support, it's entirely legitimate to say to a state, you want to do a reform, you meet those standards. And then the state the business plans operating within those states would meet those standards, and consequently they could continue to do what they were doing. So here's an example where I quite agree. You establish national standards that establish a floor that states and businesses must satisfy if they are to enjoy the protections either of ERISA or of access to or insulation from regulations that a state might impose under a state reform plan.
What you're proposing, it sounds to me, so I'm really asking you to clarify here, it sounds like that you would, what you're suggesting would lead to, would facilitate benefit specification that you can't now do.
It could be in terms of actuerial value. It needn't be in detailed terms.
Categorical
areas.
Let me go to what it doesn't seem to address.
Then.
It doesn't seem to address the issues in terms of financing, in terms of allowing, of requiring, or creating a joint employer taxpayer individual structure for financing. I mean, we've had, that's been an issue for some time. It's not entirely clear to me how Massachusetts is getting around it. It might have something to do with how little they're imposing on employers, but it's an issue that ERISA makes it difficult for a state to set up a plan like the one that that Obama is proposing for the nation. So do you see a way out of that one?
Well, you tell me then. If there's a vote to try to change ERISA, even along the lines that Henry said, but along the lines that you want, and it's not successful at the national level. You say that the state should not try to find a way to reach the same objective?
So I think the plan, this proposal, you guys developed this proposal in part, I think, out of frustration. Things were not moving forward at the national level, and I have heard at least one proponent of the plan who advocates single payer saying that it wasn't moving forward nationally, and she'd like to move forward single payer in her state. But that was then. And this is now. And I think that it is, and even you, Henry, which is very uncharacteristic, sounded optimistic at the beginning. So if you think we can have a national consensus on certain issues with the tax code, that we can have a national consensus on some others, I mean, we've got to, for God's sakes, give it a try. Good.
It's crystal clear that over the next year, the new administration is going to take a hard run at achieving as much in the way of national reform as Congress is prepared to approve. And I, for one, view that as a hopeful event and wish them well. I remain skeptical, as I think history would suggest everyone should be, about the prospects for that achieving nearly as much as the new administration hopes to achieve, and I hope they achieve. If they don't, I think it is very important that the administration and the American public think hard about how to make sure that 2 years or 4 years from now, we can look back and say, we did a heck of a lot. We made a lot of advances. We knocked the system off of the stasis, the dead center on which it's been fixed for so long, and we've initiated a process of reform that's going to be ongoing. Toward that end, I think it's very important to keep the states involved because there is a great deal of interest of diverse political sources in healthcare reform, and they are very likely, therefore, to have an important role to play if the federal effort doesn't go as far as it may go. Even if it does go that far, I would maintain, as I think Stewart would, that variations on the ground are going to require different approaches and different measures in different states. There will be uniform national standards, but we're not going to achieve 100% universal coverage instantly. We are not going to achieve uniformly efficient delivery systems across the nation instantly. There's going to be a great deal of scope for state variability and action.
Or for local, for variability.
Yes.
You know, it's certainly hard to argue with the notion that if federal fails, our next best hope is state, so we better put our hope there. I mean, there is a little bit of a tautology there, but let me just say, I want to toss out a slightly different angle on this because, again, I think so many of the value and design issues always return to this issue of coverage. And the fact is we're in a period where state finances are abysmal and everyone agrees going to get worse before they get better. And the notion that if this run takes a year at the federal level or however it does, and everyone says, okay, well, we tried it, that states are then going to be the laboratories for developing models of universal coverage, I think is a pipe dream. I do think, however, and this is maybe, again, a place to bring some
you
of
know,
this national...
You prosperity will return one
yes,
day.
Yes, but whether it will be that fast, anyway, that's a different subject. I do think there is an opportunity for us as a nation to look at the reality, and the data are just overwhelming, that we have a grossly underperforming healthcare system. Mm-hmm. It is massively inefficient. It costs too much. People don't get the right care at the right time. The list of problems is overwhelming. Those are delivery system problems that are only tackleable at the local level with the inclusion of national leadership around the levers that affect delivery, like how we pay in Medicare, mm-hmm. and whether Medicare can even participate in local initiatives designed to rethink how we pay for services so we get rid of the incentives for overuse and the like. It does seem to me that if we're going to have a second hope here, let's not make the second hope that states will solve the coverage problem. Let's make the second hope that the states, in partnership with the federal government, can take a few years, and again, this is just the second hope, but that they can, in partnership with the federal government, really look inside the black box of healthcare delivery that is growing faster than we can afford, that is the biggest impediment to achieving the consensus that's necessary, which fundamentally is how to pay for this. And let's see if we can make some progress jointly, state and national, about how we deliver care. If we could do that, then the hurdle the next time around will be lower, and the benefits in the interim will be tremendous.
Alan, what are some steps, some examples of steps states could take or have taken, and also what's standing in their way now from doing that? I mean, are there legislative waivers, like Stuart talked about, that would be necessary to make this work?
There are people who know much more about this than I, but, you know, the current move is in the primary care-centered, a patient-centered primary care medical home model where people really have a place to turn when they need services and coordination of services. States around the country are involved in initiatives designed to build the infrastructure because our primary care infrastructure is very weak in this country. Those initiatives are at different stages of development. But one common characteristic is that Medicare doesn't participate in them because the Medicare waiver process is too long. It doesn't really fit with state leadership. It fits with sort of national testing. There's no, and Medicare is the dominant payer in all of these markets. So there is an opportunity. I think around information, you know, there's huge ideological debates that we haven't been focused on in the last few months, but certainly were in the last few years about how far patient information around price and quality can drive improvements in performance, or do you need the leverage of large payers to move performance? States all over the country are experimenting with gathering data, bringing it in from different payers, insurers, trying to look at it differently and use it to create different incentives for payment to send information back into the delivery system. The federal government is a participant in those efforts, but again, they're very fragmented. The list is long, and I don't even think any one person, you know, should be developing the list. It's more a question of, is that a way to think about moving us forward in this country? I just think there are a lot more opportunities for federal framework, state leadership, state lessons when we get to some of those issues than we do about whether we're doing single payer or tax credits. That doesn't feel to me like the kind of thing you experiment in state to state.
I think exactly right. I mean, and I think you're making a very good case for a very large part of what we're talking about. That, as you say, when you look at the delivery system and the payment system, and so on. This is going to take a lot of detailed restructuring, and it's going to be different in different places, and how people think it should be done is going to be different. So set the broad objective, and as you also said, that you've got programs like Medicare and others that get in the way of this. If states could come forward and say, give us a change in the way Medicaid operates, not just a little administrative change, but a structural change, to allow us to restructure this like it looked like we were doing it on purpose, and actually so that we're not working against each other, that would make a big step forward. I would say another area like this is the whole issue of insurance organization, because when we start agreeing on broadly what we want to achieve in insurance and structures like exchanges and so on, how you do that on the ground is going to be very different in different places.
I want to get in. This is a kind of role reversal. Alan was arguing for state initiatives. I now want to argue for federal one. I think Medicare is the big hammer in the closet for certain payment reforms. Specifically, there's real attention now being paid to something called episode-based care, which has a real potential for improving the efficiency and the coordination of health care delivered around costly hospital episodes. That's one area where I think Medicare has to take the lead, principally because the elderly and disabled are such heavy users of hospital care. If they move ahead, the rest of the system will follow. And secondly, we've mentioned information technology. If we want to have an introduction of health information technology quickly, Medicare payment is the way to do it. Medicare announces that 3 years hence, there will be a 10% pay differential, depending on whether one has met federal standards for health information technology. 3 years from now, we will have health information technology because it will be analogous to Vito Corleone saying, "We have an offer you can't refuse." And we would make a great advance. So I think just as Alan was making a case for some state action, I want to make a case for federal leadership.
And I'll endorse that. It's not an either or.
I think we ought to keep clear, going back to what demonstrations are and can be. There are places where state government can play a very active leadership role. And Medicaid is a player in many places, particularly for people with disabilities and people who need long-term care. So in some cases we're talking about state government, but other times we're talking about, Stuart, when the kinds of things that you just laid out, we really are talking about testing within Medicare. You test them on the ground in different places, and depending on what they are, when they're about political choices, I think that it's become very difficult to implement them, but to put them into effect. But there are times when we have been able to test different things in Medicare, and that's not the same as having states take the initiative, and it nevertheless creates a lot of room for experimentation and learning.
Stuart, let me ask you, is there a distinction in your mind between, just following up on Judy's comment, between testing different approaches, which, you know, doesn't have to be state by state, it doesn't even have to involve state government, it could involve a federal national program like Medicare, versus almost more of a political point that it should be state government that's kind of making these different decisions?
Well, I think there's a distinction between saying we here in Washington have got this idea of what might work and we want to test it in your state. And one that says, if you in the states say, you know, we've got all these different programs and we've got a better way, former Governor Kitzhaber once said, as you know, if you just give us all the money that you're giving us in these multitude of programs, I think we can probably figure out how to cover people a lot better. So I do think what Henry and I are arguing for is that in addition to classic demonstrations, classic waiver authority under existing rules, if a state comes forward and say, we know what you're trying to achieve. We think there is a different way, a better way, by restructuring some of the existing programs to achieve your objective. In that sense, a state-initiated approach, I think, and I think Henry thinks, makes a lot of sense. That's very different from just trying out things in a state that the federal government thinks ought to be experimented. It's very different from the demonstration approach.
And do you also think, obviously the federal government has not succeeded in this, arguably the vast majority of states have not succeeded either. Is there, in your mind, anything different about the politics at the state level versus the federal level that would allow greater progress?
Well, it depends on the state, but I think there's something at the national level which is very important, and that is that we're going to see considerable debate and argument at the federal level from constituencies that, in a sense, represent states or are regional specific, because they're very worried about a particular approach in their area or their state, and they will oppose it at the national level if it's going to be imposed everywhere. On the other hand, this is precisely why somebody like Tammy Baldwin, who wants a single-payer system, and Tom Price, who was anathema, can both agree on the kind of proposal that Henry and I put forward, because what it basically says is you don't necessarily have to have the same thing everywhere, and therefore they will agree to allowing things to happen somewhere else.
But Stuart, we've been in these battles forever, and it does strike me that the primary barriers, the opposition to health reform or universal coverage at the national level has been coming from states and regions.
Not governors, but interest groups and institutions and individual politicians who disagree in principle and going in a certain way. Or disagree that a certain approach will work in their state for all kinds of reasons.
And that's where I take issue with you. I really think that a lot of what you're putting forward is workability is more a question of values and those kinds of value choices. And I don't think that the specifics of what works and what doesn't work in terms of, as Alan said, getting everybody covered is so different from place to place. And it's also true that what works payment-wise is not so different from place to place. We just need to learn more about it. We need to make the kinds of changes and do the kind of aggressive work in that regard that Henry's talking about. So I think that what you're the kind of opposition you're thinking, you're putting it forward as if we can overcome by letting states do different things, we can overcome a political obstacle. And I guess what I would say is we need, and it sounds like Henry agrees, we need to have that conversation, that discussion at the national level, and come to some agreement. And it doesn't seem to me that exceptions for states get us much further. I think it's much more a proposal that has come out of, oh my God, as Henry said, we didn't go anywhere, so let's not forget maybe there's another way.
No, I think that there certainly should be a national discussion. I don't disagree with that. I think there are values debates that are different in different parts of the country and different interests in different parts of the country. For example, who should be ultimately in control of decisions about healthcare? Should it be doctors? Should it be families? Should it be the federal government? Should it be employers? You know, those kinds of things vary quite a bit around states.
I think there are two big obstacles, one at the federal level and one at the state level, to action. And I'm going to oversimplify drastically. But the obstacle at the federal level is that there are a huge number of very diverse interests in a $2.5 trillion industry. A governmental system structured to permit action on large controversial issues only when there's an overwhelming majority for a particular course of action. That describes the way our national government was set up constitutionally and the way it operates. So the big obstacle at the national level is the intersection of diverse philosophical views about the best way to reform the healthcare system, which means the lack of a clear majority on behalf of any one position. Maybe that's changed as a result of this election. We'll find out. But the presumption that I started with was that that was a feature of the system. The big obstacle at the state level, I don't think, is that kind of political construction and the degree of political diversity to the same extent that it exists at the national level. States, for better or for worse, have narrower ranges and more similarity, except perhaps in the largest states, with respect to their philosophical view. The big obstacle at the state level is financial vulnerability when undertaking a commitment to provide, to assure access to care for everybody. So that's the reason why I suggested that if there's stasis at the national level, then providing legal and regulatory flexibility at the state level with a financial backup in case of adversity would enable the states to move forward. Now, Alan raises the question, and it's one that's come up historically on many occasions, can Congress permit significant amounts of money to go to just a few constituencies within the United States? And historically, I have to agree with you, the record on that is more in favor of your position than in favor of mine. But I was suggesting that in this case, a combination of forces from different ends of the political spectrum to which Stewart is referred. It's hard to find two people further apart than Tom Price and Tammy Baldwin. We're able to agree on this kind of an approach at the state level. There were others who shared that point of view, and there was enough there for me to think that this is something that should be kept very much alive and could be very promising, an avenue for breaking the logjam.
Do you see, when you describe it that way, I hear you, I mean, I hear the question as to whether it could come about, but I, when you talking about it as an alternative, when we can't move forward nationally, I understand, but the way you're now talking about it, it seems to me you're talking about doing something in a handful of states. And is that the way you see this?
As far as in as many states as Congress is willing to underwrite. I could imagine a system in which this was actually the vehicle for national health care reform, in which you establish national standards.
That's a different.
For financial access, but you recognized that those were going to be achieved through tax credits in a consortium of mountain states and through single payer in New England. And the federal government would provide a measure of financial support to the states, who would also be on the hook for part of the costs. And there could be different approaches to achieving these national objectives.
Well, I hate to cut this off, but we're actually coming to the end of what was a quick hour.
I'll give everyone
a final shot. But Henry, I want to key up something as a final question, what you just said to me, which was almost a financial backstop to states, providing some financial investment to states. And we frankly, have kind of danced around the financing issue, I think,
yes, we have.
Throughout the hour. And that's what I want to end with and give each of you an opportunity to talk about, which is, number one, what role does financing play in this? I mean, should the federal government be putting money into this to allow states to move ahead? And second, how does the financial crisis and the economic situation change the calculus here, whether it's the financial calculus or the political calculus? And Stuart, let me start with you.
Well, those are big questions.
And you each get 20 seconds.
Let me put it this way. Yeah. I think that, as we all agree, we are not spending money as effectively as we should do right now. Given that, it makes enormous sense to allow states in particular, and the federal government as well, but certainly states too, to say, here's a better way of reorganizing what we currently spend to reach our objective. A separate debate must take place about whether additional resources are needed and viable at this time. And that's a separate debate as far as I'm concerned. But I think it would be hard to argue that we're using the money efficiently now, and that if we invite states to figure out better ways of doing it, we won't make progress. We will make progress if we do that.
There is no more legitimately ridiculed line in Washington than, let me spend more money today so that I can save money tomorrow. But it's the line I really believe is the case with respect to health care reform. It is going to cost more money in order to provide coverage to the currently uninsured in the near term. Ensuring everyone is a precondition for the kind of systemic reforms in payment, the institution of limits, other forms of controls that will be necessary in the long run to slow the growth of healthcare spending, or in the words of the Commonwealth Foundation, to bend the curve. But at the risk of incurring my colleague's scorn, because I've heard him on the subject, I do believe that it is necessary in the near term to increase spending, and the federal government needs to be the source of that spending to a significant degree in order to cover everyone as a precondition for systemic reforms that can achieve gradual slowdown over time in the growth of healthcare spending.
And do you think there's a greater willingness to spend that money now than before the current crisis?
I actually think there are two reasons why it may be more possible. First of all, we're distributing 12-digit sums right and left to various organizations and financial groups, and we're talking about fiscal stimulus packages of that magnitude. A recent study published in Health Affairs by John Holohan and a number of colleagues suggests that it's what we're looking at is about $100 billion a year additional spending if everybody were to be covered. That at one time looked like a huge number. It doesn't look so large after reading the newspapers lately. That's one reason why I think there may be a greater chance. And the other reason is one that goes back, it's a number of years, and it's something that doesn't last a long time. During periods when unemployment is going up, people fear legitimately that they're going to lose their health insurance coverage, and suddenly assurance of coverage increases in importance and provides political cover to those who are willing to take steps to achieve it.
So I think financing has to be done nationally. States can't compete against each other for how to pay for universal coverage, if that's what we're talking about. Henry said the barrier to state action is the fiscal risk or financial risk. There's some truth to that, but states know the federal government is not going to pay the whole tab. And what states are not looking for is a federal government to just shovel more money into a broken system. I think states, because of their general fiscal conservativeness and their requirements to balance their budget, are actually more focused on cost at the first instance and are looking for reforms that give them some serious hope that they'll be able to do something about cost. That's a long-term, challenging objective. But I think states really need to feel like there's a federal commitment not just to putting money into the system but making the system more efficient. With respect to that, there's obviously a huge amount to be done. There's a lot of improvement that needs to occur. And so you ask in the context of the current economic conditions. You know, it does seem as if when we're talking about stimulus, if we could really put on the table some serious reforms that people don't talk about in polite company that would seriously drive down the cost of the healthcare system to make it more consistent with what it is in the rest of the world, that would be some great stimulus because we would be putting money back in the pockets of businesses and families that are right now stretching and pouring it into insurance. Of course, there are disruptions and all of that, but that would be some real money. And it does seem like an opportune time to have some of those conversations. I'm not sure the political agenda can fit it, but in terms of timing, it does seem like a good place to have those conversations. But it also seems like an opportunity to talk about some issues that would help build the foundation for cutting across some of the interstate variation that makes national reform hard, like building a national floor for Medicaid coverage at 100 or 150% of poverty without regard to family structure, or eliminating the two-year waiting period for Medicare eligibility, or allowing a buy-in program prior to retirement. These are things that would actually create a more uniform platform on which all states or the federal government could build the next step of coverage. And in the context of stimulus, it seems like those kinds of proposals, in addition to what the governors have talked about around just the increasing the match rate, something that actually got us to addressing some of the disparities across states in coverage would be helpful both as stimulus and as a platform for a broader reform.
You're here on the specifics there.
And Judy, you get the last word.
I would just say that I'd like to align myself with Henry's remarks. I think that this is a very promising time. And I think that the challenge that we faced in health reform, when you talked about recession and economic troubles elevating people's concerns and then creating an interest in and desire for achieving universal coverage, I think that's absolutely true. But certainly it was true 16 years ago, and that ran into the very problem that the revenues needed to provide the subsidies we need were not forthcoming or available, and that made it, I think that had a lot to do with why it was so difficult in 1993-94 to get health reform accomplished. It is a disastrous economy, and we need to say that, from which to find a silver lining, but the silver lining is that, just as you said, that now achieving universal coverage, giving people that kind of economic security and investing federal dollars in it, is regarded as building the economy for the future. And I think that gives us enormous opportunity. I believe that states, localities, and on the ground, there will always be variation, and we will always want to learn from it as well as learn as we go along. But I think the place to focus our energies right now is even beyond the stimulus is to really meaningful health reform, by which I mean getting everybody covered.
well, somehow we failed to resolve everything in an hour or even talk about anything, but it's kind of an occupational hazard. Thanks to all of you for a great discussion. I'm Larry Levitt, and you've been watching KaiserNetwork.org.